Hello. Good morning, everyone. Good morning. My name is Lisa Falsco, CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and it is such a pleasure to see everyone here today. I am impressed by all of your skills of getting across the Iron Dog Barrier, so thank you so much for trudging through the snow and making it here for this great program. I just want to say this is a program I'm so excited about. I have been pestering Dr. Zhao for about 2 years now. He might talk about that a little bit. And I'm just so delighted and thrilled that he's able to come here today and all of you that are able to see him and hear him in person. Our program is going to be recorded for the radio, so if you wouldn't mind taking a moment to turn off your cell phone or at least put it on vibrate. We do love those ringtones, but our radio listeners at home would appreciate if you just put it on silent at this moment. This program is the third program in our Global Education Series, and we are really appreciative of the generous sponsorship of Shell and BP to make this possible. Their dedication to education and educating Alaskans is very impressive, and so we really thank them for making this possible. This program, if you like this, like I said, there's one more in this series, so please visit our website at alaskaworldaffairs.org to see what the fourth in this series is. We'd also like to thank ConocoPhillips for sponsoring our WorldQuest High School Academic Competition, which was 2 weeks ago. We had 32 teams from 10 high schools compete, and I see one of the participants here, if I could embarrass him, Nathan Swan, if you wouldn't mind standing. His team came in second place, IDEA, for the second year in a row. You guys are fantastic. Service High School took it this year, and West High School came in third. And the winning team of four and their chaperone, thanks to the sponsors, get to go to Washington, D.C. in April and compete in the national competition. And Alaska keeps on doing better and better. 2 years ago, they came, I believe, in the 11th or 12th nationally. Last year, it was sixth. So with all the East Coast private schools, Alaska came in sixth, and we are expecting great things from our service high school participants this year. So thank you so much for ConocoPhillips for making it possible for students here to have that opportunity. We are a membership organization, so if you currently are not a member, there are membership cards on the table. Please consider joining the Alaska World Affairs Council. Your membership helps support these type of programs that we're presenting today, and a great lineup of programs to come. And a little bit of a spoiler alert for all of you lucky folks who are here. We are working with the Norwegian government. The King of Norway is coming in May. So watch your emails, check out our website, and see what opportunities are coming up. We have so many exciting programs. If you are a student, would you mind standing? We saw Nathan. Are there any other students? Fantastic. We love the students, and thank you so much to BP for sponsoring our students and making it possible for them to come and wake up early this morning. We'd like to encourage everyone to, like I said, check out our website, but we also have a Facebook page where we are actively posting pictures of our WorldQuest competition, our programs, our upcoming events. Like us on Facebook, join us, tweet about us, and tell us what you're thinking about and what you're interested. We'd love to hear from you. And right now, I'd like to bring to the podium Mr. Garrett Wong, who is the co-chair of our board of directors, who will introduce our speaker today. Mr. Wong.
Thank you, Lisa, and thank all of you for being here this morning, in spite of all the Iron Dog interruption and excitement. It is my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Dr. Yong Zhao. Dr. Zhao is an international known scholar, author, and speaker. His works focus on the implications of globalization and technology on education. He's designed schools that cultivate global competence, developed computer games that help language learning, and founded research and development institutions to explore innovative education models. He's published over 100 articles in 20 books, including Catching Up or Leading the Way, American Education in the Age of Globalization, and World-Class Learners, Educating Creative and entrepreneurial standards. Dr. Zhao is a recipient of the Early Career Award from the American Educational Research Association and was named one of the 2012 10 most influential in education technology by Tech and Learning magazine. Dr. Zhao's resume is quite extensive, and I know we are all looking forward to hearing his presentation this morning, so let me accelerate to the introduction paragraph on what he's been going to speak to us about today. He's going to be addressing catching up on leading the way American education in the age of globalization. So please help me welcome to the podium, Dr. Zhao.
Welcome to Alaska. Well, good morning. Thank you very much for having me. I've been trying to come up to Alaska, and every time I can, especially in January and February. I know that's the best season in Alaska. It's that's probably the most active season people can be, right? It's I always wondered what you do up here when you have 20 hours of daylight, but I know what you do when you have 20 hours of darkness. Now you work and you work very hard. So especially thank you for the students, the children. You know, you are still children, by the way, Eric, and even though you are 16, that's still considered a child. Okay, but thanks for getting up early and come to think about this. I think both education and globalization are tough issues I think we all face in different countries. Especially, I think the idea of globalization is really bringing up different images in different places. And in this country, in the U.S., we've viewed that as seriously as a global competition, you know, global competitiveness, how the Chinese are stealing our jobs. You know, that's the idea of globalization for most Americans right now, and how do we stop that? As you know, in America, actually, it's really interesting. If you follow the politics, how they interpret globalization, I found, to summarize, this some Australians told me this. So in America, the Republicans hate foreign people but love foreign goods. And the Democrats hate foreign goods but love foreign people. And that summarizes Americans' view towards globalization. That's how we deal with this. And so as you can see, why we want to talk about globalization and education, because the students today, as Abraham Lincoln said, you know, this philosophy in our classroom today is the philosophy of a government tomorrow. That's the idea. So I'm very happy that you can be here. So I want to start by introducing to some ideas we've been thinking about. I think a lot of times, human beings, I was talking to Paul here, and was about the political systems may mean a lot, but it's really a cultural mindset that drives our thinking, you know, and that actually drives a lot about how we educate and how we run our political system. And then when I wrote this book, I was concerned about this authoritarian mindset in arise in the U.S., so that's why I wrote this book. But just to show you some how stereotypes drives us, I was really interested in some of I've seen some of the crazy images, but you can see this, it's funny. This is what we call the world according to ancient China. You can see. Right? You know, we are the land emperor. Everybody is can be a trashy subject, the southern morons and western morons surrounding China. This action view, I know the historians may have a very different perspective, but actually quite stereotypical, and it summarizes the view. Because for a long time, we didn't even care about other places. You know, China for a long time is about protecting our best place. And as long as you don't mess with us, we're fine. We don't want your land, your people. It's really interesting that it's never tried to expand. And every culture operates under some kind of stereotypes, you know. And I came to America, you know, I don't think America does the same kind of thing. If you look at the U.S., we are the land of awesome. You look at those things, and we got all this other country have different views of them. You know, it's anyway. So this is if you think about this, is what I call mindset drives a lot of things. By the way, the action this if you want to find these maps called stereotype maps It's actually they are drawn by a German. So it's the Germans' perspective of other people's perspective of other countries. It's quite interesting to think about this. How we, I would encourage you if you are a teacher, you should go home and in a classroom ask your students to draw their stereotypes of other people. When I'm teaching a class called Globalization and Education at the University of Oregon, we always start by doing that in asking people to confront their stereotypes of others, what it means. But really, and today, I want to talk really about what does it mean to be educated in age of globalization. I'm sure Alaska is working on something called common standards. You're not part of the Common Core because your governor was very busy with something else at that time when the Common Core came out. Do you remember that time? At that time, actually, there was three states who did not sign on to the national movement of the Common Core at the time we came out. That's Alaska, Texas, and South Carolina. And Alaska, of course, you know, you had a reason. I think Governor Palin was busy with other things. And Texas was the only state that had a reason not to belong to do this. And Texas does not want to do anything with the union anyway. So that's they had legitimate reason. And South Carolina, I think that was Governor Sanford. He was busy hiking the trail at that time. Did not have time to worry about the Common Core stuff. But I was in Texas last week. So right now, Texas has its own Texas Core, and US, now Alaska has its own version of this. They're very much doing the same thing. Actually, a lot of them are doing the same thing. It's basically prescribe a set of standards, content for all students. They're doing the same thing. And the term they use is called college and career readiness. So remember, we want to make sure our children are ready for a career and ready for college. So that's the idea. But as I have examined a lot of these so-called reforms, is that is education ready for that purpose? If so, really, can we truly make our children ready for careers that don't exist yet? And how is that going to work? And I must share with you that I have children. When I see Lisa's son here, Eric, you know, I have a daughter who is 16. excuse me. And Champagne, you've met her. And when I look at my own children, you know, of course, I want them to be ready for life. I always talk about it's life's readiness. And I have a son as well who just graduated. He was college ready. He was very ready. He was ready to go to one of the most expensive colleges in this country. That's University of Chicago. You know, it was very ready and cost me a lot of money. Because as you know, in this country, the worst place you want to be is in the middle, right? So he was ready to get in, but he was not so ready to get any scholarships. So I had to pay for everything. And for us as professors, you know this, that we make enough money not to qualify for any assistance, right? But we don't make enough not to worry about the money, right? You know, that's very interesting. And then, so he went to school, he went to Chicago, and he was going to major in economics. That's, you know, kind of a mandate for all Chinese. He was going to major economics, going to make some money and work in the bank. After 2 years, he decided to change. He said, "Dad, I'm not really going to do this anymore." I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, there aren't too many Chinese, Asians, economics anyway, and I want to do something else." I said, "Okay, what do you want to do?" He said, "I want to do art." I said, "Okay. That sounds good, you know." So he switched to art history, and he graduated with honors and high honors last year. So we had a conversation about the meaning of education. We said, "So you finished, you've done whatever people ask you to do, and did well. You know, you've been a good student and graduated, and you've spent a lot of my money." And so what do you think? And we were just chatting. He said, "Well, you know, first of all, it may be a sad thing for, you know," he said, "for you, because your son majored in art. You know, in China, that's, You only major in stuff like that when you cannot do other things. You know, they think nobody voluntarily want to major in art, right? You want to do medicine, law, accounting, you know, business. If you look at business schools, perhaps like 90-80% of them from Asia. You know, it's like many. And so he says, I kind of feel bad for you. I said, well, why do you feel bad for me? He said, well, you know, how can you explain to your friends, parents? I said, no, I don't want to worry about that. He said, you're not, he feels like a failed Chinese child. I said, but you are in the U.S. now, you know, you may be a failed Chinese, but you can be a successful American, you know, that's different. But I said, you know, it's just one thing we can chat about. I said, whatever you do, if you can stay out of my basement, it'll be great. So I've always thought about the ultimate goal of education is out of the basement readiness. It's a good education, no matter you're global or you're not, is to keep other people's children out of their basement. And you may love to have them come back to visit, but the independence you give them as citizens is necessary. You know, out of basement meaning financial independence, psychological independence, and social independence, right? That's something very simple. So when I think about all this common core or this movement, what are we talking about is, are they going to give our children out of the basement readiness? So that's something we got to really ponder. And currently, the record in our education is not doing, actually it's not very good in keeping our kids out of our basement. And you probably know right now, our recent college graduates, over the last 5 years or so, over half of them are not out of their parents' basement. They're unemployed or underemployed. And this is not to say don't go to college, okay. We're going to talk about that later. They're unemployed or underemployed, meaning that many of them do not have a full-time job or are working on jobs that do not require what they were trained for. And so this is a, but that makes, like if you go to any big city, I think Anchorage might not be so different, is that we see America actually should be very proud of this fact. We have the best educated generation of bartenders. It's pretty good, right? And I'm not sure chemistry majors make better cocktail, but you know, that's a fact. You go to any big city, you see a lot of taxi drivers, baristas, and all these people, they're really work on those things. But this is not a US phenomenon, no. It is actually a global phenomenon. China, I'm sure if you're familiar with China now, this year, graduates over 7.29 million college students. 7.29 million, that's seven Alaska? Eight Alaska, right? If you want a college graduate, just send some containers there, you're gonna increase your college, you increase your education level in Alaska overnight. You know, but many of them do not have a college, degree guaranteed job. And in fact, actually right now, China's big problem for the government is what to do with its college graduates. And many of them do not earn a salary that's consistent with their degree, and they don't earn as much as migrant workers. So China, very interestingly, because in China, this parents and government think dropout, college dropout is a shame. It's really big. So they guarantee, China has over 99% of graduation rate. I think it's put everybody in shame. But now, 2 months ago, in December, the Chinese Ministry of Education suddenly issued some executive suggestion to all universities. Say, you should allow your students to pause their higher education and go become entrepreneurs. Stop going to school, go do something else. Right now, the whole entire government is thinking about children get out of school. This is, you haven't heard of this before. And the same thing happened in Korea. When the new president came along about 2 years ago, she said, skip college, kids. We got too many, it's not working anymore. If you go to Australia, their youth unemployment rate has hit probably, I think, about 12-year high. And Canada, you guys' borders, the same issue with this. So we have seen this amazing youth unemployment globally. European countries, you know, EU countries have the same problem. If you go to the UK, go to, of course, Spain, that's all have the same issues. So, but this is not, by the way, a result, direct result of the financial crisis. It had something to do with it, but because now we have, we cannot blame the financial crisis forever. It was 2008, right? We've seen the rebound of business. You look at our stock market, it's going up. Our unemployment is going down, but youth unemployment haven't been resolved. At the same time, globally, you hear this, another problem is called, we have this talent shortage. In the US, you go to business, people say, okay, we don't have enough qualified people. And the Chamber of Commerce of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai every year produce a report. They said in China, doing business, the hardest thing for doing business in China is they cannot find the right talent. So it's not bureaucracy, it's not corruption, it is talent. So you think this is kind of ironic, right? You got 1.3 billion people and 7 million college graduates. You can't find people to work for you. So what is the problem? Well, in essence, US, globally speaking, everybody's looking for talents, everybody is finding for a job, so there is a mismatch. So what do we call this is a global talent mismatch. It's not a talent in shortage or surplus. We've been educating our children for the wrong economy. So it's very, very simple. It's actually, this kind of things happen all the time. New York Times wrote the article New York Magazine said, America has this boomerang generation. You know, boomerang generation, the Australians, we throw you away, you come back, and you never live again. That's what we have, a lot of parents. So that's all our basement kids. And so what happened there? These children are not poorly educated, they're miseducated. They're educated for an economy that does not exist anymore. It's fairly simple logic. So what has happened? And let me bring you to think about the major forces that have changed our society. And whenever big changes happen like this, we have a problem. So we call this the race between education and technology. Education always runs a race to catch up with technology because technology always, always changes the value of talents, skills, and knowledge. It's very simple. And they redefine everything. So let me just give you an example of how does it redefine, how technology changes. And I was thinking about myself. I was born into a village like this. So this is my ring, the house I was born in China's Sichuan province. Still stands there in the village. And so when I was born in this village, imagine my village as a nation, as a country. If you were working on in my village, what's the most important skills or the common core in my village you want to make sure every child knows? So in this one, in this village, well, there are really two big things for guys, for boys. One is to how to drive the water buffalo. Another one is how to carry heavy things on the dangling pole. Remember those things? And I have to tell you, I wasn't good at either of those. So I was not even good as this kid. You know, water buffalo was not my thing. So I was placed in a special ed program, you know, and I do more makeup stuff right there. I was not gifted and talented with this. And ultimately, in terms of the assessment in my village, I was a failure. So I've always claimed, I've done all of this work, but fundamentally, I'm a failed Chinese peasant. Just never worked out for me. But luckily, there was another world outside my village. That's called a school. In my village, I was the worst. I'm glad my father's, you know, kind of kicked me out. Said, don't mess things up here. Go do something else. I went to school in the 1970s in a village. There was no direct pathway. You know, remember school, university were kind of abolished. So my father sent me to school purely because I enjoyed it. Purely because I was not good at doing the village thing. Not because he had the utilitarian view that you will be ready, go do something. There was no path because it was the whole Cultural Revolution destroyed everything. So Symphony said, you know, go to that place. So I went to school, and it is in school that I discovered I could be good at something. So I was good at reading, and I was really small and physical, not strong. So I was bullied by all other high performers in my village in other things, and so that's how it happened. But once I went to school, I was good at something. I really enjoyed that. So going to school was a way to escape the reality. So thinking about the power of school. And then I went to school and it was good. And I found something also valuable and utilitarian, because I began to enjoy reading and doing math. And then the guys who did better in water buffalo, climbing the trees, were not good at this. They didn't enjoy it, but they still had to do the school. So school was misery to them. That's when I began to develop some collaborative skills I call outsourcing skills. So I began to outsource my personal protection to the big guys. I said, I will do your homework, I'll let you copy my exam, and you do my fighting for me. So that was global outsourcing. I start with that, is that you outsource your weakness to other people. And so that's how, imagine education. So we began to touch on one important thing about education, is that what does it mean? You know, whenever technology that defines what's in my village, what's in a school, what's valuable in one place may not be valuable in another place. So my village was going through the transition. So what, you know, if I were a good peasant, it wouldn't work now. So our school, think about the big change in human society. So if schools continue to prepare more farmers, but there's nothing to farm, it won't help. So maybe what we're doing, the Common Core, all these things, maybe we're continuing to prepare farmers instead of preparing people who work in a new age. So that's where we have to think about. So now, how did this change happen? Well, there are really two big changes over the last 30 years that has affected all of us, that's created this education or talent mismatch. Number one, is as we started thinking about, is globalization. Thomas Friedman, you know, is an interesting guy. I don't agree with a lot of things he says in the implications, but he was the one who announced the arrival of the age of globalization. In that sense, you know, at least in the popular culture, you know, but the idea of the age of globalization, as many of you know, is nothing new. It's been happening a lot. Except today, in the last really 30 years, it has arrived at a time that we are truly, truly kind of connected now because of technology. To me, globalization means one thing. It's called the death of distance. That is, distance does not matter anymore in many aspects of human life. Many, not all, but in many aspects of human life today. And one of the things majorly, I think, is in terms of education, is the availability of a global market. That's it. And that has two meanings. One is that all human talents, if you treat as human capital, just one aspect, are treated on the global market, like oil. So whatever you know has to be compared to what other people know in another land. So there, henceforth, we have this problem called outsourcing or offshoring of jobs. If the same talent can be purchased with less money in another location and the transaction cost is so low because of death of distance, that job will go there. In the US, we start shipping jobs out to other countries in the 1970s, making shoes, textile, t-shirts, now to computer programming, now to financing. It's from lower to higher. That's what happened. So that's number one. Question for us to ask. Maybe our college students, the ones are in our basement, maybe they have acquired skills that can be acquired much cheaper in other countries. That is true. If you look at all our technology, our global things, that's happening right now. It's computer programming in India. In the US, I don't know, you guys will be ready for this. America, we spend on average $115,000 per student for 12 years in public schools. China, probably 10 to 15,000. India might be 8,000. So we spend 10 times more Now imagine our college spend even more. Our college is much more expensive than Chinese colleges. So if you just purely from investment perspective, if you spend so much more, but your cost should be higher, but your talent is only worth much less. Why would you have a job? You shouldn't. I was joking with my son. I said, my brother and sister still in the village. I said, the money we've spent on you, public and private school, you could have bought like 10 villages and be the kind of managed all of them. And why would you want to be competitive with those people who don't even have an education? So that's a big challenge for all Americans. You know, it's also ethically wrong when we have command so much resource, so much more than other countries, to think about you would compete with a kid in Tanzania. It's morally wrong. You should be creating opportunities for them. So that's the global competitiveness is completely wrong. So it's economically impractical and morally, you know, unethical to think you want to compete in that way. So we have to do something else. That's why a lot of college kids can't find a job because, you know, a lot of them are gone. The second major change is we call the arrival of the second machine age. The second machine age is in relation to the first machine age that was started by the steam engine, you know, caused industrial revolution. That started the first race between technology and education. Because technology, when industrial revolution changed a lot and required different kind of people, now the arrival of the second machine age changes again the value of talents. Second machine age is driven by a new type of machine, the digital technology. Digital technology, what it does, it is it really get rid of a lot of the skills we used to train for human beings to do. A lot of jobs, for example, you might remember that we used to have a lot of people working on jobs like this. You know, I was in Michigan, we've seen that a lot of people, these were good middle class jobs. And now, if you go to most of the factories, you will see this. This is what you will see, it's right now. And so we have seen machines replacing lots of human beings. And not only in this area, you look at, I know you guys don't pay tax here, but you still pay federal tax. And you remember that TurboTax, this online software program, has replaced a lot of tax accountants. If you were a lower tax accountant, you don't need you. When I first came to this country, I saw a lot of people, H&R Block, they set up tables in a shopping mall, you know, in the 1990s, they did your tax, they made some money, you know. And now TurboTax. Now in America, you have another, if you go to law school right now, we have actually a surplus of law school graduates now. And in different, if you're not very good law school, you're not gonna get a job. But that's not a result of America's lack of interest in suing each other. We are still suing each other as much as possible, and we just don't need many. And one of the simple reasons, as you know, in law school graduates, a lot of them, you do legal research. When you do legal research, remember how much more time and how many more people require when you go through page by page the legal cases? Now it's digital databases. And actually, you should give it a try. Try to go through 1 year of congressional records by hand, just hard copy. Try that. How many hours will take you versus online? Right now, you get online on your phone, you type in, you can get in minutes. That's the shift. That's the big change. And we're seeing the same thing in medicine. You know, you have great surgeons and actually people especially can really monitor operations in different locations, telemedicine. If you are simply doing your traditional check, your vital signs, your blood pressure, the iPhone might be able to do that. The tracing, all of this is shifting a lot of this kind of change. So these two things have made our children return to our basement because we were still basically producing children to compete with skills and knowledge can be acquired much cheaper overseas and compete with machines. So we should not try to compete with machines. Ask ourselves for the future, whether in the US, actually anywhere, they have to ask the same question. Are you developing skills and talents that cannot be replaced by machines or done cheaper elsewhere? Even in China right now, Foxconn, you know, the one who makes the iPhone, is bringing a lot of robots. And that's even that low level jobs is going to be replaced. And China actually faces the same challenge. You know, a lot of times Chinese they can mobilize a large number of people to put the glass together. It's not worth much. The skill doesn't work, but require human beings. Now machines become more sophisticated. They don't need to hire people anymore. And also China is losing a lot of jobs to Vietnam right now. And Vietnam, Cambodia, Bangladesh, Nike shifted most of its manufacturing to Vietnam already. So there's no guarantee. We are not the land of awesome. Therefore, we deserve to have everything. So we got to face this idea. So you're all here to think about what does the future really want? What can we do to keep our children out of the basement? So we have to think about this. So what is it? Well, there are several things that are kind of interesting. When some technology, when they devalue certain skills, they increase the value of something else. As you know, human beings are extremely, extremely diverse, right? So I want to just bring back to one more point. Accept the idea of human beings are very diverse. And we are born different. We actually are born with different propensities. And so I want to go to make a summary of what I said before I move on to something else. This is what I call the known knowns in education. By the way, you know the known knowns who came from? Rumsfeld, right? It's as a English language learner, I came to America. I noticed American politicians are extremely creative with language. And I always remember George Bush confused me one time. I thought my English was bad. He said, remember what I say? He said, do not ever underestimate me. Do not ever underestimate me. It's a great word, right? He invented it. Underestimate. It's a very good thing. And I heard Jeb Bush is adding more to this Bush canon, I think. Bush also one time said, more and more imports are coming from foreign countries. More and more imports come. I think that's even right. That's even correct. More and more imports are coming from foreign countries. I will just talk about known. This actually makes sense. When Rumsfeld told about the situation, either I think in Iraq or Afghanistan, was saying, well, there are known knowns, there are unknown knowns, there are known unknowns, you know, and there are unknown unknowns, you know. So it's really logically possible. So known knowns basically means certain things that are shared, understood by everybody. So these are the known knowns into this education. Most of us agree, actually, is number one, more recent neuroscience research and brain research shows human nature that we are extremely diverse. We're not born a blank slate. We're not waiting for you to ascribe on us. So some people are born more talented. Just look at physical build is different. Not even cognitive. Just think about physically. How many Asian football players have you seen? We're not good. I'm not going to try it. I'm not going to try to get an Asian scholarship from playing football, you know. And the NBA, you know, how many Yao Mings do we have? They're anomaly. You know, remember those things? It's how many, really, they may become better. You get baseball players. There are certain things you actually just cannot do. But at the same time, most of us are born with some basic things. We can all play the ball, but how great you can be is different. And music, language, everything. You actually think about the human talent. It is really interesting to think about the human talent. We've heard about this idea of this multiple intelligence many, many times. People are different talents. Some are math people, some are language people. So, but this one thing gives them a lot of times a myth. Some people like to believe we are talented in every aspect. That's not true. Multiple intelligence means if you are talented in one area, you cannot be equally talented in other area. That's the problem. But also the good side of that is that if you're bad at something, you must be good at something too. That's another side of the story. So you have this, but then this by the way, Howard Gardner's talk about this. These are not the only talents we have. We have all kinds of talents. These talents are identified only because they correspond to some valuable profession. That's all. That's it. That's because we have other talents. If you create some new thing, we just haven't been able to label those people yet. Yeah, I was doing some review about gifted education, for example. Everybody is gifted, but we only make those people who are considered useful as gifted. You see what I mean? So that's our problem with our traditional education. So anyway, with this, we have to add really two more factors to this one. One is that we're born different. Most people have the ability to learn the basic things. Like we can all be trained to draw. We can all paint. But very few of us, no matter how hard you try, can become a Picasso. So you see, that's the difference, is that we can all learn the basic math. But if you want to be as a great mathematician, that might not be possible. So that is where this we call aptitude inferences orders. Then the second factor is environment. So it's not nature versus nurture. It is nature via nurture. That is nurture, your environment, your teaching, your family, your home background can either enhance or suppress what you have. And for example, I think I could have become a Justin Bieber. You look at me. But never had a chance to try it. And I never got to see the music instrument until I went to college. So that gene might have always been suppressed. I might try it again, sometime, but I don't know how far I can get there. Because that relates to another factor, is time. If you want to be good at something, you got to spend a lot of time on it. Even if you were born with a genius, that's the idea of Malcolm Gladwell's Outlier talks about 10,000 hour rules. If you want to be good at something, spend 10,000 hours on it, but 10,000 hours alone doesn't work. But at the same time, if you spend 10,000 hours on one thing, you don't have the same 10,000 hours for something else. So that's what we have, number one. Human talent. We're extremely different. We're born creative, all of this. However, when I was talking about this, the idea, the economy has changed, information is everywhere, world is globalized. The economy, the traditional economy, does not endorse all talents. Remember I said, all this, like in my village, we only value strength, physical strength, and animal handling stuff, all those things. And reading literacy was of little value when I was there. I could read. People say, so? What do you do? And so that's the thing. Well, today, how do we treat this idea of diversity is key. So that's why most of our education, we followed a model trying to homogenize people. This is what in a traditional society, from farming to industrialization, in the industrial age, we could only make use of a very narrow band of human talents. We are different, but we could only use a very small band. Everybody, we had art talents, music for a long time. But how come all the time we had very few great writers? Even when we had Shakespeare, I'm sure there are many people who are as talented as Shakespeare, but they didn't go very well, those times. And how many artists did we have all the time? So for a long time, schooling, especially public mass education, were designed to serve the industrial age. Remember the race of between education and technology. Technology redefines, so farming is not important. We need what? We need a lot of people with similar skills who really do not even care about what they do. We call compliant workers with similar skills at the mediocre level. So we needed a lot of mediocre workers for the industrial age. If you were trying to work for Henry Ford to make cars, we don't want you to be creative. Remember that Henry Ford would find no use in Lady Gaga. You don't want to buy a car assembled by Lady Gaga, right? That's a very simple thing. You don't want that. All our schools were designed to ensure what the society thinks is useful, is necessary. We view that. So that's how we began to fix curriculum. We call whatever is included in the curriculum is considered valuable. And if you happen to be good at what the school curriculum requires, you are considered gifted and talented. If not, you go to the special education program. That's what we try to fix you. And this model, we fix people. Actually, this model is a deficit model. We look at you. We don't look at you as individual student. We look at the standards, the outcome. And that's what we call outcome-based, data-driven. We look at outcomes and what we want and how well you meet my expectation. So we have authoritarian view of this whole thing. So the whole model is a homogenization model. Basically, that's how we do it. So today's school, in almost every country, is about fixing people. That's why it have this model. We assume you're sick. We're going to kind of treat your disease. And if you're not good at reading, I'm going to give you more remedial lessons. Do you notice this is almost absurd, but yet we do this. We treat literacy and numeracy as the highest. You're good at them, you're considered great. Even if you could do it, it's something else, but we don't really care. And that's how we do it. And that's why we use this to force all schools to homogenize this model. Now, this is the why we miseducate our people, because in a new society, the new economy does not reward mediocre, homogeneous talents anymore. So what do we value now? Where's the future? I remember still out of the basement idea. Well, with the increase in productivity brought about by technology, we have arrived at another age, which Daniel Pink calls the age of abundance. The age of abundance. What does the age of abundance mean? Basically means now we have more resource that we do not need to secure necessities anymore. You look at it, we are an internet leisure society. And unlike my village is the age of necessity, where most people in my village had to spend all the day really securing food, shelter, and clothing. So at that time, we consume physiological necessary goods. It's very homogeneous. Now, once you arrive today in the age of abundance, what do? We now began to satisfy our psychological and spiritual needs. Psychological and spiritual needs are much more diverse than physiological needs. So now today, we suddenly open up. In this new age, this diversity of needs changed. For example, we don't consume what's necessary. We want to consume what's desirable. Have you heard your kids say, "Dad, I need an iPhone 6? Yes, you tell them, "No, you don't need one, you want one." So we consume wants. We don't consume needs. Then that's really fascinating. Once you look at this thing, it makes useless talents useful. Traditionally useless talents useful, traditionally useless people useful. For example, Kim Kardashian actually is a good example of how traditionally useless people have become useful, right? Do you guys know the Kardashian story? Okay, has she ever been up here in Alaska? No? Okay, she invited her, it's kind of fun. And I just look at her and she is one of the category of people, and she's not in her parents' basement. You know, that's one thing. She might be building her parents some basement. And I met her once, but she never met me, so just doesn't count. And I just saw her in this Melbourne Hotel, Australia, and I saw a lot of people following her. So I talked to my daughter, asked who is this Kim person, and her is Kim, and it might be Kim Kardashian. I said, people following her. Daughter said, "Well, she's a celebrity." So I said, "Celebrity for what?" And actually, the answer is celebrity for nothing. So we have a new group called Celebrity for Nothing. And if you look, actually, most of this stuff are celebrity for nothing. So why do we consume nothing? Nothing is spiritual and psychological. Let's take a look at this. So don't laugh at this, people. We all do this in the age of abundance. When I first came to this country, 1992, arrived in Oregon, this is a kind of traumatic experience for me. I could not buy shampoo just in front of all these aisle shelves because I did not know what kind of hair I had. You know, you got to know. It's oily, normal or dry? It's, do you know your hair? I'm sure you all know, right? You know what shampoo to use, right? And people, I said, what, does it really matter? And I had one bar of soap, I was rationed a year until every inch of my body was fine. There's no problem. Is it necessary to have all these choices? Do you guys go to look at hair products? And this morning I was in the hotel, I look, there's not shampoo anymore, they changed. And there's no shampoo or conditioner, it's called Purifier and Protector. I said, which one should go first? I don't know, you know. And you know all the brands, and then you look at do we need all of this? No, when you look at how many flavors of potato chips do you have? And then another thing you look at, you go to a restaurant here now, the more money you pay, the less food you get. What are we consuming? We're consuming choice. Psychological and spiritual are very much about choice. So that means really one thing. Today, we no longer need to homogenize talents. If Kim Kardashian is useful, anyone can be useful. That's our first lesson. The future liberates us. The future allows us to truly, truly benefit from the endowed diversity in human talents. But yet our schools are not doing that. See, our schools were still trying to define people based on external standards. That's number one. To be out of your parents' basement, you got to capitalize on your strength. And your strength, remember, if you try to fix your deficit and ignore your strength, what you would end up with? Let's take a look, example of Michael Phelps. Actually, it's quite interesting guy. The guy who is the swimmer. Remember the swimmer? Won a lot of medals. I think he has if he were not a great reader, if he were not, I don't know if how good. Let's imagine if he was in your school, right? And he said, well, he wasn't a good reader, but, you know, today, according to their standard, we want to be responsible. We want to make sure he can read. I mean, because reading is so fundamental. Remember those things? And instead of trying to let him swim, but trying to fix his literacy, what would have happened to him? He would still perhaps be hooked on some phonics in the basement, you know. He would be hooked on phonics in the basement. I would not be a great swimmer, right? So you have produced a mediocre reader, sacrificed a great swimmer, right? Just that's what we do, we fix people. So that's not one thing we need to think about, expand. Number two, we cannot just simply expand anymore. We have to capitalize on creativity. Creativity, everybody's born with creativity. But that's your potential. Remember, potential, you can enhance or you can suppress. Today's schools, we do not enhance creativity. Actually, we suppress creativity. We don't think creativity is very valuable. I'm just showing one photo like this one. You look at kids like this. In our schools, we think, no, we don't want this. This one is not school ready. Right? Because there's nothing, that's inherently good or bad about creativity. Creativity means deviation. You come up with something original, you're different from others. So how do we tolerate difference? And that's very interesting. You know? And so that creativity is considered something valuable only very recently. If you look at human writings, actually creativity as a concept was not even written about in the millions of Google books after 1920s. If you go to Google books, you can type in concept, you can trace when was the idea written about. The millions of Google books, they didn't even write about creativity. If you type in about, but they've been writing a lot about children, you look at how little we write about creativity. It's just recently began to realize the rise of the creative class, like Richard Florida says, creativity becomes important. So our school were designed to suppress creativity, to homogenize our children. That's why when our children, with age 5, 98% of them are creative at the genius level. By age 10, that means after 5 years in our school, we've successfully got rid of some 60% of the creative people. They become good students. They become good. Then another 5 years, we go over to age 15, 10% are left. And then you go to college, you find a job, you become good employee. We got 2% left when age 44. And creativity has potential to bounce back after retirement. After George Bush is pending now. Okay, that's good. good evidence. And so imagine that. It's now just think about this idea. Why does creativity bounce back? It's very simple. Creativity is not only cognitive, it's psychological, it's emotional. You know, it's cultural. Do you view, for example, are you allowed to be different? Do you feel you want to be deviant and different from others? And certain cultures suppress that. But after retirement, said, well, I don't care anymore, especially when you come to Alaska, whatever, you know, I'm going to live my own life. I want to be creative. So it's not only cognitive. That's why in our schools, when you train people to score well on tests, you're suppressing creativity. Because tests reward your ability to find answers, not your ability to challenge the status quo. So the better you are as a student passing those tests, the more likely you are going to become less creative. And did you guys notice right now we have a lot of people in this country, actually every often, most of the dropouts were the inventors, and then they've set up companies and they hire those graduates. If you go to Silicon Valley, you do notice that that's a general trend. The graduates follow orders, and the dropouts create something. That's very different. It's that. So individual talents, creativity, and one final thing we cannot escape, that is the entrepreneurial spirit. Entrepreneurial spirit does not mean you have to be a business entrepreneur, but rather you have the startup mindset. You assume nobody owes you anything. You assume there's no job waiting for you. You assume you have to be the job creator for other people. So the entrepreneur spirit that we have business entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs, we have intrapreneurs, that's people creative within the organization, policy entrepreneurs. So we are looking for a completely different set of qualities today. For all children, you cannot really assume you'll find a job. Education has to shift from preparing job seekers to job creators. And that spirit is completely against the idea of being a good student. A good student is a good employee. Well, that's, you know why in the US? US, by the way, is the most entrepreneurial country. But still, only 5% of our college graduates only want to become entrepreneurs, which is very sad. They're happily sitting in the basement without doing anything. You remember how much education they've had? They're supposed to be leading the whole thing. They're still waiting for someone to give them a job. At the same time now, with the rise of authoritarianism in the U.S., the same thing. We're waiting for the big government to solve our problem. They won't. They won't. We government, you know, they can't solve our problem. You know, government is our problem. You know, just that's what we got to do. Our students have to become entrepreneur-thinking citizens, too. If you don't like something, do something. Teachers, we have to be entrepreneur, too. If you don't like government regulations, we got to do something. The entrepreneur spirit comes from confidence, friends, risk-taking, all the things. Craig Whitmore told friends, risk is the social network. This is the one why I do not like the idea of some in a school called collaborative skills. It goes way beyond that. It's social intelligence. It's social networks. It's not about what you can collaborate. You have to find out who you want to collaborate with. And how do you sustain those? It's social capital. It's much broader than the training skills, because the so-called 21st century 4Cs are still trying to prescribe a curriculum for everybody. So the confidence. Now to end, just want to show you one piece of data. Where does confidence matter? If you want to become creative, entrepreneurial, confidence actually underpins all of those activities. And many people are trying to explain a very interesting phenomenon, a global education phenomenon, that is US versus Asia. As you know, in the US, right now you hear this conversation saying that American education is in decline, is getting worse every year. That's why we need all these reforms. But historical data suggests American education is not in decline, is not getting worse. It has always been bad. It has been bad for a long time, a long, long time. And how long? 1958, we were worse than Soviet Union. 1980s, we were worse than Japan. Now we're worse than China. And statistically, test scores, first international mathematics study in 1964, US 12th graders ranked 12th out of 12 countries
in math. That's pretty bad. You can't get worse than that. We've never had a good score, you know. But this country, America's still here. You know, that's and not only here, you know, according to Obama, we still have the largest, most prosperous economy in the world, which is actually true in 2014. It's even true. And, well, this is, I call this really factual. It's more factual than some of Obama's other facts, but this is it's quite interesting. So you have to wonder this question. We've been bad for over half a century. Why is America still here? This is not a Canadian question, okay? It's a serious historical question to think about. Why? But Asian countries have had a great test scores for a long time. Every time it goes up, Asian countries in all this. So how do you explain this? I just want to use one piece of data to explain this. I think it has to do with idea called confidence. American students have always scored below Asian kids. Like 2003, TIMSS is called Trends International Mathematics Science Study. We score way below Asian kids. Singapore is number one. Singapore, Hong Kong, Korea, Japan, Taiwan. On this test, it has another question, it has called confidence. And the question is like this. I usually do well in math. Strongly agree, strongly disagree. You know, American students, we are really bad at math, but we are all very confident. So we're out-confident everybody. You know, we think we're better than others. You know, that's how we think. So now you look at this. This is actually not between the only U.S. and Asia. It actually is a global phenomenon. All the 40-some countries participating in this study showed a negative correlation. Countries with high scores always have a lower confidence. You go to Korea, you go to Japan, you go to Hong Kong, they're always lower confidence. They are not confident they can do this. And there's many reasons for this. But you look at the 2011, we have the same results. What I call the East Asian countries, they score way below the traditional Anglo-Saxon countries. By the way, I've jokingly said this is the chopsticks versus forks. It's more of a, if you use chopsticks, you score better in math. You know, but if you look at second column, you have this confidence. You look at Korea, look at Japan. Shocking, right? This is very interesting. Now, how do you explain this? Actually, it's more interesting. American says that our children are too happy for their own good. They have high confidence because they don't know how bad they are. They don't know how bad they are because we have lower standards. Therefore, we need to raise standards and test our kids more often. That's the Americans' reform over the past 20 years. Asian countries took a different approach. Since 1990s, they've been complaining about how their children have no confidence, no enthusiasm, no interest. Because they know without that, they can't become great writer or scientist. They say we lost intrinsic motivation. I was actually recently reviewing some books and writings in Hong Kong. Said if we remove testing, the Asian kids don't want to learn at all because they have extrinsic motivation, confidence. So to relate, actually Finland has the same problem. Finnish students score very high on science on the PISA, but no interest in science. They call it a national security problem now. So entrepreneurship, the same kind of categorization. Countries with higher math scores on the PISA have lower entrepreneur confidence and entrepreneur activities. So this, by the way, leads me to make a suggestion for the future. Keep our children out of our basement. We need an education paradigm shift. That's what developed countries requires for us to create a better future. Our children will not fit in the future. They are the creators of the future. So you guys don't come in to say, we will belong to this. No, we do not have a position for you. You create the position. In education, we forgot about it. We always think we prepare our children for the future. No, we prepare our children to create their own future. And the future is about enhancing every student talent. That's really come down to three simple things I think we need to think our children should do. Number one, our education with so much money should be able to endorse, enhance everybody. We should turn our education into personalized education. It's a school of one, not a school of 100. Students should be driving their own curriculum. It's not a national curriculum. There's no reason for our students to be meeting the state expectation. Yeah, education is about the growth of individuals. If everyone becomes more capable, more rational individual, we might have a better society. You know, that trying to make everybody the same. It's number two, our education, our every day, our children should learn to engage in making authentic products and services. We are very lucky to consume so much resource. But our children for 12 years have been deprived of the opportunity to serve a real purpose. You guys want to do something. You know, being able to learn to identify other people's needs, to help others, we are in a privileged position. And through that, you develop entrepreneurial skills and thinking. You become better because entrepreneurs are the ones to better other people's life through their efforts. And finally, we have to imagine our school is not the campus. The globe is our campus. Every day, every time, you can learn from, with, and by, and for each other from truly everywhere globally. So just to end, what we need to do, learn from Kim Kardashian to be great. Today, we don't need mediocrity. You have to be great, unique, globally minded, and have a service mindset. Thank you.
Well, Dr. Zhao, thank you for freeing me from my homogenous Asian upbringing. But we are going to take questions from Dr. Zhao in just a minute. I just want to say on behalf of the Alaska World Affairs Council Board to thank Dr. Zhao for being here. We have a token of memorabilia for him to take home. And we hope he comes back soon to visit with us to explain how the world is evolving in his direction. So with that, I'm going to invite Dr. Zhao back to the podium to take some of your questions. Please wait until Kari gets with you in the microphone so that we can keep the recording going. So Dr. Zhao.
Thank you.
Thank you for your very informative and yet entertaining presentation. Tamagosti Giesler, and I'm a member of the school board, so I'm listening carefully to what you're saying. One remark that I thought was curious is we have right now in America a huge preponderance of young adult dystopia. And in this dystopia, the heroine or the hero is always somebody who is divergent or who breaks the mode. And I'm wondering if the younger generation is still getting the message through their literature that being different and being creative is still a desirable trait, even though schools are trying to beat that out of you.
Well, that might be the saving grace, actually, we do. So the diverse, that's why I talk about culture. Schools have never endorsed divergent thinking. So it's in our culture, I think, parents. But I'm very concerned the rise in authoritarian thinking in America is even destroying that piece right now. Because we are seeing more and more middle-class parents actually endorsing the agenda of homogenization. And I call that these parents trying to minimize maximum regret. So they're forcing their kids along a pathway to say, go to college, go to better college. And so we're not seeing that. And that rising authoritarianism is very well on its way right now because parents began, as you're on the school board, you know, they do use scores to judge schools, teachers, and individual students. When they come back, kids come back with a B or C, they do get concerned. I never look at my kids' report cards. I just said, no, I don't want to look at that. It doesn't matter to me. It's that kind of thing. I mean, as Asian, it's very hard. It's very hard to do. But we do that. I said, you cannot prejudge a person's value. Even with that, I have to say, children today, a lot of them, so-called middle-class kids, have been sold the bill of homogeneity. You know, a lot of them don't really have a passion. If you're asking, what do you want to do? What are you passionate? What do you want to devote your life to? Many kids don't have that. I'm lucky. My son found that when he actually went to college in the second year. And by the way, he's happening out of my basement. He's not in my basement. He works for the Chicago Arts Club. He's really happy with that. So that's something I'm more cautioning, loss of that. And school should be instead actively promoting something different.
Thank you. I enjoyed your lecture very much. I'm Mary Gibson. I'm director of philanthropy for a large oil company in the state. And I'm always looking for good ways to invest our philanthropic dollars. And of course, education's a big thing. But I did see one slide. I just finished reading a book called The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. And they used a lot of the basis for that, the PISA test. Tell me your thoughts on the PISA test and its value.
Well, I've been very, that's Amanda's book of the smarts. I've been very troubled by that book. I think it's an interpretation of achievement without understanding the cost. So the PISA, I'm going to use the PISA is a great example. I've written a lot about PISA on my test and on my blog. It's I wrote about called How PISA Puts the World at Risk. It's a 5-part writing. So the PISA, for those of you who don't know what PISA is, it's called Program for International Student Assessment. It's assessment of 15-year-olds for every 3 years. Now it's the largest international academic horse race or iron dog race. And it is used to measure, supposedly, I debate with PISA group all the time. 2 weeks I was with Andrea Schleicher in British Columbia. He leads the PISA. It's the best marketed idea. So he glorifies a lot of education system, what I call the glorified miseries of other countries. And so now one problem with the PISA claims to measure what they call 21st century skills. Not only what you do, you can, but what you know. And one example, Singapore scored number one on this test called problem-solving skills. PISA has been adding new things. They know they cannot measure anything else. They do measure math, science, and reading. I was in Singapore, and they said they were kind of proud. And I was Minister of Education, and other people there. I said, you may be able to solve a problem, but do you know what problem is worth solving? That's one thing. Just look at. And then we look at most of PISA countries. Right now, the PISA top countries, top seven, Asia. Look at Shanghai, Korea, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Vietnam, Macau, Singapore. They've always scored high. But if you look at all these countries, they are not really proud. They're happy to have it. They actually, a lot of Chinese was written, the high scores of Chinese PISA, the number one, is precisely their problem. They're probably because they go after test scores, the PISA. And the PISA, there's many other problems. The PISA is actually a flawed test. It is only a test. That's what. So Amanda Ripley's book, Smartest Kids Club, is based on the wrong thing. Actually, I'm finishing two books. I just finished one called Counting What Counts. So you look at all the scores. One of the things, why test scores don't really matter. You look at the traditional, we used IQ scores to make drastic political decisions. We used to exclude immigration based on IQ scores. But it has no real bearing on people's future. The SAT scores you guys going through, they have very little predictive power of your future. So test scores only indicate your ability to take the test. If you want to learn more, I can just talk more about this then. And I've written a lot about why PISA scores are not a good indication of education qualities of a student or school.
Wanted to thank you very much for that very lively discussion. I am a university educator. I'm an historian. I teach East Asia. And I note that both China and the West, we have a tradition of classical education. And what I'm hearing, well, I'm not sure that you're intending to send this message, is what I'm hearing is kind of an endorsement of the sort of liberal education, the idea that it's kind of skills rather than knowledge. It's being a little, getting what you measure in terms of tests and being a bit skeptical of that. Am I hearing you right in that respect? Is there room for kind of the classical or the liberal education in your future?
Well, I think, my view is always education is supposed to provide opportunities for human development. And whatever that might be, I don't think education is going to produce a workforce for a state.
they may happen to be. I think that we have too much view in this utilitarian value of students. So yes, I would say a liberal basic education is valuable, but we cannot force everybody to do the same thing. So I was actually at Delaware to talk about, we have this little group of professors who are all kind of refugees from dictatorial countries. And this Eugene Mustov is from Russia. We have another professor out of former Romania. So we all become very conscious about imposing upon people a predefined set of curriculum. And so, but that curriculum, you can offer liberal arts, you can offer broad things. But every children can be given that, but they should always be given a choice to personalize. Yes, please.
Hi. My name is Caitlin Poindexter, and I'm an academic advisor at Alaska Pacific. And thank you for your talk, because it was really resonated with me. But I advise for a program for students that are seniors in high school and also freshmen in college. They're doing their year simultaneously, and they tend to be high achievers. You know, they're wanting more from their high school education and wanting to start college early and that kind of thing. But something I've found is they don't want to have to analyze. Because of technology and having all of this stuff at their fingertips, they kind of feel like, I've got the answer. Like, I can find it for you. Let me hit Google for you, and I'll show you what it is. But they don't want to, like, weed through the information, which I kind of understand. It's overwhelming. But what has been your observation on that? Like, I just have found it interesting, because here I have these really intelligent students, but it's like, just give me the answer, and I know I should be able to get it in 3 seconds, and I don't really want to think about how that could be different or how the variety of answers there might be.
Well, thank you. That's a very, very important question to ask, because now we are observing that. And by the way, in universities, we're observing the new generation of college kids coming in after No Child Left Behind. They demand answers. They do not want to ask questions, which is very sad. You know, like I teach graduate school students, some of them are principals, teachers, they ask, so how many pages do you want this paper to be? And double-spaced, single-spaced, 12-point fonts, I said, I don't care, it's your job. You know, so that's an employee mentality. The company said, so what do you want me to do? That's the loss, that's the concern we have in this country now. This is the mentality you have in a lot of Asian countries. They are here to do a job, and according to what you want. So there's no difference than we write a lot about this idea. The thing, passing a test is much more important than knowing something, because they do not learn to train themselves. And also that's because of the lack of engagement. They don't think this writing a paper means anything. So school is more like playing. School is like gambling. And you pass, let's say pass the test, you get a reward. I wrote a lot about this examination mentality is that you pass the test, so it's caused a lot of cheating, fraud, because it's not about learning, it's about passing the test. And that's a very dangerous role we do. And another reason is our children are not right now, because whatever they make doesn't really make any practical difference. Do you know that our children, a lot of things they do, they don't make practical difference. So there's really no meaning in their life. So we need to shift that whole. That's why, I mean, I think even as the rep from oil company, what investment we should be making is investing in children in authentic products. One thing I was wondering, anybody should do, they should build a global network of children who are interested in making meaningful products and services to help other people. And that's something we need to make. And once you go that far, you actually learn to become great. Let me show you one example. I know we're running out of time, but this greatness concept is really important. And because our school rewards mediocrity. So by the way, high test score is actually mediocrity. You know, just even 2400 is mediocre, because anyone can achieve that. It's something that's beyond measurable. That's great. So Austin is a 7-year-old first grader.